53 sat there in an almost catatonic state. So the doctor got up, went to him and slapped his face, first one side and then the other. 53 jumped to his feet in rage and then slumped. "Well, what can I do?" he said. "I'm being sent back to Earth as a member of one of a deplorably low form of life. I am not used to being of such low status." The doctor looked truly sad, and then sat down on the bed beside 53 saying, "Look, my boy, you are making a grave mistake, you know. Supposing you were on Earth now and you were a member of the theatrical community. Suppose that you had been offered the part of King Lear, or Hamlet, or someone like that, well, possibly you would jump at such an opportunity. But then after the play was over, after the audience had gone, and after the producers had decided upon a new production, would you insist that you were King Lear or Othello or Hamlet? If you were offered the opportunity of being, for example, the Hunchback of Notre Dame or Falstaff, or someone of lesser status, would you say that such was unworthy of a person who had been King Lear or Hamlet or Othello?" The doctor stopped speaking. 53 sat on the bed idly scraping the floor, scuffling the carpet, with a foot, and then he said, "But this is not play acting. I was living on Earth, I was a member of the upper class, and now you want me to be, what is it? The son of a publican, the son of a bus driver, or whatever." The doctor sighed, and then said, "You were upon Earth to live out a part. You picked, before you went to Earth, what you thought would be the best conditions for you to enable you to be a successful actor. Well, you failed. The act was a flop, so back you go to a different condition. You've got a choice, in fact you have five choices. Some have no choice." He jumped to his feet saying, "Come, we have dallied too long already and the council will be becoming impatient. Follow me." He moved to the door and then, on an impulse, turned back to the table and picked up the file marked 53. Tucking it under his left arm, he reached out his right hand and grasped 53 by the arm, shaking him roughly. "Come," he said, "be a man. You are thinking all the time of how important you were as an officer. Surely an officer and a gentleman doesn't behave like this cowardly slobbering person that you have become?" Sullenly 53 got to his feet and together they went to the door. Outside a man was just coming down the corridor. "Oh," he said, "I was coming to see what had happened. I thought perhaps our friend was so overcome with sorrows that he couldn't get off his bed." "Patience, friend, patience," admonished the doctor, "we have to show tolerance in a case like this." Together the three men walked along the corridor, back through that long tunnel again, past the watchful guards who this time just inspected them, and then they went on to the door. "Come in," said the voice, and the three men entered the room. This time there was the elderly grey-haired man sitting at the head of the table, and on either side of him there were two other people, one man and one woman, dressed in their long green coats. The three turned to look at 53 as he entered. The man at the head of the table raised his eyebrows and said, "Well? Have you decided which you should be?" The doctor nudged 53, who was standing there in sullen silence. "Speak up," he whispered. "Can't you see they are losing patience with you?" 53 stepped forward and without being invited to do so slammed himself down in a chair. "No," said he. "How can I decide? I have only the briefest details of these people. I have no idea of what conditions I will encounter. I know I find a publican as extremely distasteful, but possibly an ironmonger would be even more distasteful. I am quite ignorant of such people, never having encountered them on a social basis in my life. Perhaps you, sir, with your undoubted experience, would be prepared to advise me." 53 looked insolently at the man at the head of the table, but he just smiled tolerantly and said, "You are extremely class conscious, and I agree with you that the honorable trade of innkeeper or public house manager or ironmonger would be too much for your subconscious. I could indeed, though, very strongly recommend that eminent public house in Cable Street, but for one of your type given to too much snobbishness I will, instead, suggest another family, that of the greengrocer. The father is Martin Bond and the wife is Mary Bond. Mary Bond is almost a full term, and if you are to take over the body of her as yet unborn child, you must lose absolutely no more time. You must come to your senses and decide, for only you can decide. Greengrocer. Thought 53. Rotten potatoes, stinking onions, overripe tomatoes. 4. However did I get in a mess like this? He twiddled his fingers, scratched his head and squirmed miserably in the chair. The others in the room kept quiet. They knew of the desperate state which one got into at having to make such a decision. At last 53 raised his head and said defiantly, "Well, I will take that family. They might find they've got a better man in their family than they ever had before." The woman sitting at the side of the table said, "Mr. Chairman, I think we should run a series of checks on him again, because we have to see that he is still compatible with the mother. It would be a terrible thing for the woman if after all she has gone through her baby was stillborn." The man at the other side of the table said, "Yes," and he turned to look at 53. "If the child is stillborn, that still does not help you, because you would be returned here on the grounds that your lack of cooperation and your intransigence will have caused the woman to lose her child. I do suggest, for your own sake, it really doesn't matter to us, that you cooperate more, that you try to make a more equable temperament, or you may find that we shall have to send you anywhere like garbage being thrown out." The woman rose to her feet, hesitated a moment, then turned to 53 and said, "Come with me." The chairman nodded and also rose to his feet. The doctor touched 53's arm and said, "Come along, this is it." Reluctantly, like a man facing execution, 53 climbed sluggishly to his feet and followed the woman into a side room. Here things were very different. The whole walls seemed to be flickering lights behind frosted glass. There seemed to be a remarkable number of knobs and buttons and switches. 53 thought for a moment that he had got himself into an electric power station, but then directly in front of him was a peculiarly shaped table, a very peculiarly shaped table indeed. It seemed to be the outline of a human figure, arms, legs, head and everything. The woman said, "Get on that table." For a moment 53 hesitated. Then shrugging his shoulders, he climbed onto the table, brusquely brushing off the kindly hand of the doctor who tried to assist him. As he lay on the table, he found a most peculiar sensation overtook him. The table seemed to mold itself to him. He had never felt more comfortable in his life. The table was warm. Looking up, he found his sight was not so good as it had been. It was blurry. Faintly, indistinctly, he could make out shapes on the wall in front of him. Vaguely and strangely uninterested, he gazed at the wall and thought he could distinguish a human form. It seemed to be a female form. At a rough guess, 53 thought she was in bed. Then, as he watched through lackluster eyes, he had an impression that someone was pulling back the bedclothes. A distorted voice came to him, "It seems to be all right. I say he is compatible." It was very strange. Very strange indeed. 53 had an impression that he was going under an aesthetic. There was no struggling, no apprehension, there was not even clear thought. Instead he lay there on that form-fitting table, lay there and gazed up uncomprehendingly at the people whom previously he had known so well. The doctor, the chairman, the woman. Vaguely he was aware that they were saying things: compatible basic frequency, temperature inversion, a period of synchronization and stabilization. And then he smiled drowsily and the world of purgatory slipped away from him and he knew no more of that world. There was a long sounding silence, a silence which was not a silence, a silence when he could feel but not hear vibrations. And then suddenly it was as though he were thrust into a golden dawn. He saw before him a glory such as that which he could never remember having seen before. He seemed to be standing bemused and half-conscious in a glorious, glorious countryside. In the distance there were tall spires and towers, and about him there were many people. He had the impression that a very beautiful figure came and stood beside him saying, "Be of good heart, my son, for you are going down to the world of sorrow again. Be of good heart, for we shall be with you keeping contact. Remember you are never alone, never forgotten, and if you do that which your inner conscience dictates, no harm will befall you but only that which has been ordained, and at the successful conclusion of your time upon the world of sorrows you will return to us here triumphant. Rest, be tranquil, be at peace." The figure turned away and 53 turned over in his bed or table, or wherever he was, and slumbered, and was at peace. And he knew no more in his consciousness of that which had happened. Chapter 6. Algernon shuddered violently in his sleep. Algernon? 53? Whoever it was now, he shuddered violently in his sleep. No, it was not sleep, it was the most terrible nightmare he had ever in his life experienced. He thought of an earthquake which had happened near Messina, Salonica, where buildings had toppled and where the earth had yawned and people had fallen through to be squashed flat as the earth, yawning, closed again. This was terrible, terrible. This was the worst thing he could ever experience, the worst thing he had ever imagined. He felt that he was being mashed and squashed. For a time in his confused nightmare state he imagined that he had been caught by a boa constrictor in the Congo and was being forced willy-nilly down the snake's throat. All the world seemed to be upside down. Everything seemed to be shaking. There was pain, convulsions. He felt pulverized, terrified. From a distance away there came a muffled scream, a scream as heard through water and thick swadding. Barely conscious in his pain he made out, "Martin, Martin, get a taxi quickly, it's started." He mulled over the name. Martin? Martin? He had a vague, but only a very vague recollection that at some time somewhere in some life he had heard that name before, but no, try as he would he could not bring back into his memories recall what the name meant or to whom it was applied. Conditions were just terrible. The squeezing went on. There was the horrid gurgling of fluids. For a moment he thought he had fallen into a sewer. The temperature increased and it was truly a shocking experience. Suddenly, violently, he was upended and he was conscious of terrible pain in the back of his neck. There was a peculiar sensation of motion, nothing that he had ever experienced before. He felt suffocated, stifled, he felt as though immersed in fluid. "But that can't be, can it?" he thought, "man can't live in fluid, not since we emerged from the sea anyhow." The joggling and jolting continued for some time, and then at last there came a jolt and a very muffled bubbly voice snarled, "Careful man. Careful. Do you want her to have it here in the taxi?" There was some sort of mumble in reply but it was all dreadfully muffled. Algernon was nearly out of his mind with confusion. None of this made any sense to him. He just did not know where he was, did not know what was happening. Things had been quite fantastically terrible of late and it was no longer possible to act as a rational being. Dim memories floated into his consciousness, thing about a knife somewhere, or was it a razor? That had been a terrible dream. He had dreamt that he had half hacked off his head, and then he had looked at himself while he was hanging halfway through the ceiling, upside down he was, too, looking at himself lying dead on the floor. Ridiculous, completely absurd. Of course. But, and what was this other nightmare? What was he now? He seemed to be some sort of a convict accused of some sort of a crime. He did not know what it was at all. The poor fellow was nearly out of his mind with confusion, with distress, and with fearful apprehension of impending doom. But the joggling went on. "Careful now, careful I say, go easy there, bear a hand behind will you?" It was so muffled, so unreal, and the tones were so coarse. It reminded him of a costermonger he had heard once in some back street of Bermondsey in London. But what had Bermondsey got to do with him now, where was he? He tried to rub his head, tried to rub his eyes, but to his horror he found there was some cable or something encircling him. Once again he thought that he must be in a lower astral because his movements were constricted. This was just too terrible for contemplation. He seemed to be in a pool of water. Before it had seemed to be a sticky mess when he had been in the lower astral, or had he been in the lower astral? Dazedly he tried to force his reluctant aching mind to search along the paths of memory. But no, nothing was right, nothing would focus with clarity. "Oh God!" he thought worriedly, "I must have gone mad and be in an asylum for that condition. I must be having living nightmares. This just can't possibly happen to any person at all. How could I, a member of such an old and respected family, have come down to this? We have always been respected for our poise and our sanity. Oh God! What has happened to me? There was a sudden jolt, a most inexplicable occurrence, a sudden jolt, and then the pains came again. Dimly he became aware of someone screaming. Normally, he thought, it would have been a high-pitched scream, but now everything was muffled, everything was so incredibly strange, nothing made any sense anymore. He lay back in wherever he was and found that this time he was on his face, and then a sudden convulsion of something whirled him about, and then he was on his back again, shuddering with the whole fiber of his being, trembling in terror. I tremble? He asked himself in horror. I am nearly out of my mind with fear. I am an officer and a gentleman. What is this evil thing which has befallen me? Of a verity, I must be suffering from some grave mental affliction. I fear for my future. He tried to clear his mind, he tried with all the mental power at his command to think what had happened, what was happening. All he got was confused, improbable sensations, something about going before a board, something about planning what he was going to do. And then he had been resting on a table. No. It was useless. His mind recoiled at the thought, and for a moment went blank. Again there came a violent movement. Again he was convinced that he was in the coils of a boa constrictor being prepared for crushing and digestion. But there was nothing he could do about it. He was in a state of utter terror. Nothing seemed to be going right. How had he got in there? Clutches of the boa constrictor first, and how would he be in a place where there were such creatures? It was all beyond him. A terrible screech muffled badly by his surroundings shook him to the core. Then there came a violent wrenching and tearing, and he thought that his head was being torn from his body. Oh my God! He thought, then it is true, I did cut my throat and my head is now falling away from me. Oh my God, what shall I do? Shockingly and with terrifying suddenness there was a gushing of water, and he found himself deposited on something yielding. He found himself gasping and struggling. He seemed to have a warm wet blanket over his face, then to his horror he found pulsations, pulsations, pulsations. Strong urgings were forcing him through some very narrow, cloying, clinging channel, and something, it seemed to be a cord fixed around his middle, tried to hold him back. The cord he could feel twisting around one of his feet. He kicked violently to try to free it, because here he was suffocating in humid darkness. He kicked again, and a wild screech, louder now, burst out from somewhere above and behind him. There was a further terrific convulsion and twisting, and he shot out of the darkness into a light so dazzling bright that he thought he had been struck blind on the spot. He could see nothing, but from the very warm surroundings he had had now he was precipitated onto something rough and cold. The cold seemed to seep into his bones and he shivered. To his amazement he found that he was sopping wet, and then something grasped him by the ankles and whisked him up into the air upside down. There was a sharp slap, slap, across his buttocks, and he opened his mouth to protest at the indignity, at the outrage perpetrated upon the helpless body of an officer and a gentleman. And with his first scream of rage all memory of the past faded from him as a dream fades at the opening of a new day, and a baby was born. Of course not every baby has experiences such as this, because the average baby is just an unconscious mass of protoplasm until it is born. And only when it is born does consciousness take over. But in the case of Algernon, or 53, or whatever you want to call him, the matter was somewhat different, because he had been a suicide, because he had been a very difficult case indeed, and there was an extra factor. This person, this entity, had to return with a special purpose in mind. He had to take up a special vocation, and so the knowledge of what was that vocation had to be passed on from the astral world through the being-born baby and straight onto the mental matrix of the new-born baby. For some time the baby lay, or was moved about. Things were done to the baby, something attached to its body was cut away, but the baby was oblivious to it all. Algernon had gone. Now there was a baby with no name. But after a few days in the hospital, vague shapes came and moved in front of the infant's blurry vision. "COO," said a somewhat crude voice, "runty little devil, Annie? What you going to call him, Mary?" The mother, fondly gazing down at her firstborn, looked away and smiled up at the visitor and said, "Well, Alan, I think we are going to call him. We decided if it was a girl we'd call her Alice, and if it was a boy we'd call him Alan, so Alan it's going to be." After a few more days, Martin called for his wife at the hospital, and together they left carrying the small bundle which was starting out a fresh life upon the earth, a life which none of them knew at that time was destined to end 30 years on. The baby boy was taken away to a home in what was a fairly presentable part of Wapping, well within sound of the hooting of the tugs on the Thames, where the great ships in the Pool of London came and hooted their welcome at getting back into a port, or screamed farewell with their sirens as they left the Port of London to go out again on a journey perhaps to the other side of the world. And in that little house, not too far from Wapping Steps, a baby boy slept in a room above the shop where later he was going to wash potatoes, toss out bad fruit, and cut away rotten leaves from cabbages. But now the baby boy had to rest, had to grow a little and learn a different lifestyle. Time went on as time will, it has never been known to stop, and the little boy was now 4 years of age. On this warm Sunday afternoon he was sitting on Grandpa Bond's knee when suddenly Grandpa leaned down towards him and said, "Well, what are you going to be when you grow up, boy?" The boy mumbled to himself and carefully examined his fingers, and then he said in a childish treble, "Doctor, doctor." Having said that, he slithered off his grandfather's knee and ran shyly away. "Well, Grandfather," said Mary Bond, "it's a funny thing, you know, and I don't understand it at all, but he seems dead keen on anything to do with medicine, and I'm just 4 years of age. When the doctor comes he won't let go the doctor's, you know, thing around the neck, that tube thing." "Stethoscope," said Grandpa. "Well, yes, that's what I said, stethoscope," quoth Mary Bond. "Can't understand what it is. He seems to have got a real obsession about it, and how can he think of being a doctor with us in our position?" still went on. Alan Bond was now 10 years of age, and for a boy of 10 years of age he was studying quite hard at school. As a teacher said, "I don't understand about Alan, Mrs. Bond. He really does study, and it's absolutely abnormal. It's not natural for a boy to study like this. All the time he is wanting to talk about doctoring and things like that. It's a tragedy really, because, no offense intended, Mrs. Bond, but how can he expect to be a doctor?" Yvonne thought about it all the time. She thought about it in the long stillnesses of the night, when only the roar of traffic, to which she was immune, and the hooting of craft upon the Thames, to which she was accustomed, broke the night stillness. She thought long and hard, and then, at last, in conversation with a neighbor, she had an idea come to her. The neighbor said, "Well, you know, Mary, there's a scheme out nowadays that if you get 'em young enough you can get a child insured. You pay so many pence every week for sure you've got to pay, and then at a certain age, you decide that with your insurance man, at that certain age a boy can get a big sum of money which will put him through medical school. I know there's such a scheme. I know of a boy who's done it already, he's a lawyer. I'll get Bob Miller to come along and see you. He'll talk to you about it, he knows all there is to know about these insurance schemes." The neighbor rushed away full of good intentions, full of planning another person's future for him. The years went on, and at last Alan Bond entered a grammar school. The headmaster interviewed him on the first day at school. "Well, my boy, and what do you propose to be in your life when you leave school?" "I am going to be a doctor, sir," said Alan Bond confidently, looking straight at the headmaster. "Oh well, my boy, there's no harm in having these high aspirations, but you will have to study very hard to be a doctor, and you will have to get many scholarships, because your parents definitely cannot afford to pay your way through medical school and provide all the extra expenses which are incurred. I suggest, my boy, that you try to have something as a second string, as it were, to your ambitions. Damn you, boy. said Martin Bond, can't you put down that blasted book for a minute? Haven't I told you to scrub those potatoes? Mrs. Potter will take her custom elsewhere if we let her have potatoes with great gobs of soil on them. Put your book down, I say, put it down, and get busy with them there, Spuds. I want em spotless, and when they're spotless you go and deliver them to Mrs. Potter up in the high. The father moved away in exasperation, muttering to himself, damn it all, why do kids have ideas all the way beyond their station nowadays? That's all he thinks of nothing else but being a doctor. How the devil's he think I'm going to get the money to pay for him being a doctor? Still, though, he thought to himself, he's a real whiz at school, they say, and when it comes to brains he was in the first line when they were handing em out. He's working hard at school studies, really trying to get a scholarship. Guess I've been a bit hard on him. He can't study properly when he's got a book propped up in front of him and I make him scrub the spuds. I'll go and give him a hand. Father Bond went back to where his son was sitting on a three-legged stool in front of the bath. In his left hand the boy had a book, with his right hand he was groping wildly to find a potato, and then he would just drop it in the bath of water and swish it around a bit and then flip it out onto some folded newspapers. I'll give you a hand for a bit, boy, then we'll get these things done up and you can go off and do your studying again. I've no wish to be hard on you, boy, but I've got a living to get. There's you to keep, there's your mother to keep, and there's me as well. And we've got to pay our rent, we've got to pay our taxes, we've got all manner of things to pay, and the government don't care a damn about us. Come on, let's get em cleaned up. It was the end of the school term. The headmaster and the teachers stood upon a dais. There were members of the school board there, too, and in the great hall children sat done up in their very best Sunday clothes, scrubbed, uncomfortable, and embarrassed. Beside them, fidgeting in the unaccustomed surroundings, sat parents and relatives. Here and there a thirsty man would sneak longing eyes out of the window and across at a nearby pub, but this was prize day, speech day, and all the rest of it, and they had to stay here. One man thought to himself, well, pajabas, I've only got to come here once a year, the brats, they've got to come here every day. The headmaster rose to his feet and carefully adjusted the glasses upon the bridge of his nose. He cleared his throat and gazed blindly at the congregation before him. I have much pleasure, he intoned in a most scholastic voice, in telling you that Alan Bond has made quite phenomenal progress during this last school year. He has proved to be an absolute credit to our tutorial methods, and it gives me much pleasure to announce that he has been awarded a scholarship to the Pre-Medical School of Street Maggots. He stopped, waiting for the wild applause to die down, and then raising his hand for silence he said again, he has been awarded this scholarship, which is the first to be so awarded to any boy in this parish. I am sure that all of us wish him the very best of success in his career, for, in the 4 years he has been at this school, he has consistently and persistently asserted that he was going to be a doctor of medicine. Now he has his chance. He fumbled at the papers on the lectern before him, and a whole bunch of papers fell off and the sheets became airborne and went fluttering over the dais. Teachers hurriedly bent down and retrieved the falling sheets, carefully sorting them and placing them again on the lectern. The headmaster riffled through some papers and then seized upon one. Alan Bond, he said, will you come to me to receive this diploma and the award of the scholarship which has just been confirmed? I dunno, said Father Bond when they got home and Alan was showing them the recommendation. It seems to me, Alan me boy, that you're getting ideas far above your station in life. We are just green grocers, we don't have no doctors nor lawyers in the family. Know why you get these wild ideas. But father, cried a despairing Alan, I've been talking about becoming a doctor for as long as I could speak, and now all my school life I've worked, I've slaved, and I've denied myself all pleasures to study and to win scholarships. And now I've got a scholarship and you are raising objections again. Mary Bond, Alan's mother, sat silent. Only the way her hands could not keep still betrayed the difficulty she was having. Father and mother looked at each other and then the father said, look, Alan, We are not trying to keep you back, boy. We are not trying to harm your chances, but you got a bit of paper. Well, what's that paper mean? It just means that you can go to a certain school and your schooling will be free. But how about all the other stuff? How about all the books, all the instruments, and all the rest of it?